Welcome back, everyone, to Tax Crime Junkies. I'm your host, Dominique. I'm a CPA, certified tax strategist, leader of the American Institute of Certified Tax Planners with a degree in law. And with me, as always, is my oh-so-lovable co-host, Tom Gorzinski.
Hey, everybody. I'm Tom Gorzinski. I'm an enrolled agent. I'm admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court as a non-attorney. I'm a tax planner. And like you, I love true crime. I love tax, and Dominique and I have this great podcast called The Tax Crime Junkies. Today, we have the first part of a special two-part episode with our guest, enrolled agent Frank Kelly, who was charged with a tax crime and was found not guilty in a jury trial. We are very lucky to have Frank here to tell us what happened in this very unusual case.
If you haven't listened yet to Frank's story, go back to episode 32 and make sure you hear about what happened to Frank in this story.
Frank, welcome to Tax Crime Junkies.
Frank, thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate your time, especially this time of year. But, you know, Tom and I thought this is a story that absolutely has to be told.
Yes, it is.
I have been talking a little bit about this episode with some friends and colleagues that are in the industry. And of course, it scares the pants off of everybody. And so I want to know from you as we get started, did it scare the pants off of you too?
Well, I'd have to be laying horizontal 6 foot under with no pulse for it not to scare the pants off of me.
Gosh, what did you do most to cope with that feeling? I mean, at a certain point, as I'm reading through your case, it's like I have this feeling of despair, you know, in the pit of my stomach.
I knew in the bottom of my heart, I knew in the bottom of my stomach, I did nothing wrong. I knew that I received a notice of intent to investigate me for a violation of Title 26 of the United States Code, having to do with conspiracy to defraud the United States government. Well, that is so far out of my realm of possibility, my persona, that I knew that that was wrong. I had no idea where this was coming from. I called the AUSA. The AUSA would not take my call. He told me I had to go get an attorney. I went and got an attorney. My attorney told me, yes, you're looking, they're investigating you for, according to this letter, they're investigating you for conspiracy to defraud the United States government under Title 26. I said, what does that mean? He says, well, that means that they have some reason to believe that you defrauded the United States government in your job as a tax professional.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there with two attorneys and my wife. My wife, by the way, went to every meeting I had with the attorneys and the one meeting we had with the AUSA.
What was her reaction?
Total stunned disbelief.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, especially when you know, as you were saying, you know that you were honest and you didn't attempt to defraud the United States. So it's got to be a disconnect there. Like, I know that I did. I don't ever do that. So what does this possibly mean? And it's interesting, too, because it's not like the notice you receive tells you, you know, based on your work with client X. At what point did you learn which client was involved in this?
Well, the first meeting we had with the attorney was, actually it was a $10,000 meeting. He wanted a retainer of $10,000. And he took the letter and said, I'll get back to you. 2 weeks later, he's calling and setting an appointment for Karen and I to go into the office. We went and talked to him. And he said, They have written evidence that you and a past client entered into an agreement to conspire and defraud the United States government of tax dollars. And I'm shaking my head and I said, hey, what? Who are you talking about?
You're like, me?
They said that, do you know Michael Powers? I said, oh, yeah. He had Powers Automotive. He was in an audit for a 1099-K mismatch. And the case, I was the rep on the case, and the case went south, and he ended up pleading guilty for tax evasion to the tune of $110,000 plus a year in unreported income, taxable income. The attorney said, well, they have an offer on the table for you right now. Plead guilty, a year in jail, $30,000 fine.
Wow. But that would mean saying that you actually conspired with MP to pull this off.
Yeah, that would mean that I conspired with Michael Parris to defraud the United States government, yes.
Which, of course, is not true.
No, it's not true. And after that meeting, he said, I'll get back to the AUSA and see what happens. And as we got up and walked out the door, and I said, you know, guarantee you, one, I did not do that. And two, you've met a guy that's lived the proverbial Boy Scout life. I live by those rules. And the attorney just looked at me. So we left.
Well, and he's getting to know you, so he doesn't know your background and your business.
There's no way they have this in writing. I did not do this. They did have it in writing from the revenue agent.
So it was the revenue agent's written notes of what reported to be the conversation that they had with you, not that you actually wrote anything down that was incriminating.
Which doesn't seem to hold the same type of weight when they tell you, we have it in writing, kind of implies that you said or did something that they have proof of, but it's not your own writing.
That is correct.
Did you come to a point, Frank, either with your attorney or maybe even by the time you got to trial, where you started to kind of put the pieces together on what happened from your client's perspective? Like, do you think this was a setup?
Well, let me turn the tables on that. If I would lie to the AUSA or an investigator, I would be charged with obstruction of justice. But I believe they have free rein to do what they need to get a conviction or to get an indictment.
At the heart of this case with MP is what they're calling him in the documents. He basically got an examination notice. He brings it into you looking for representation. And what jumped out at you in looking through his documents and helping him to prepare to submit these for review, you noticed unreported 1099.
No. I started representing February of 14. And to this day, I have never seen the full amended return from anyone other than the revenue agent. I never got the amended 11 return. Harris never gave it to me. He used an uncredentialed preparer to do that. The uncredentialed preparer redid the bookwork, redid the returns, and included all $360,000 of the 1099-K. And then they added a whole bunch of expenses to it. Had Mike sign the returns and send them into the AURU, signed. The revenue agent showed up to talk to Michael and said, you cannot use this guy to represent you. You need a CPA, an attorney, or an enrolled agent. All I had on the very first meeting with the client was the original AUR. I did get the original returns for 10, 11, and 12. I did get the original computer-generated checkbook registers for 2011 return, pushed out for AUR mismatch in 2013 when working with Mike Powers on this. I started somewhere around February. We were working back and forth. The revenue agent was there in April, late April, early May. I tried to get a hold of the revenue agent in May, June, and July. I went back in October and tried to get a hold of the revenue agent. Did not try to get in November. No success. I went to Mike Powers week before Thanksgiving and said, Mike, I think this case is going south. I think they're looking at criminal charges against you. We need to find an attorney. I said, do you have a criminal attorney? He said, no, I wouldn't know where to start. I said, okay, I'll find one for you. Called Dennis Boyle and gave him an overview of the case. Asked him if he's interested. He said, yes, that's right down my alley. Dennis Boyle got here on a Monday morning early, 7 o'clock. Nobody was around. And I don't want anybody around other than the parties involved when that happens. And anybody that's been through NTPI or anybody that's been through any criminal educational courses will tell you, you want to keep this as tight and compact as you can so that it doesn't get out, people to get around. Dennis came in. I gave him another review. Mike Parris came in. And they started chit-chatting back and forth, and they said they were friends. I said, I will step out of this room. I did offer to work with them under a Coverdale letter. There was 3 weeks of discussion back and forth with the attorney between himself and me. And finally said, no, I don't think I want you under a Coverdale letter. you know too much. You could be a witness to the IRS and you can't not talk about what you already know. Fair, true, accurate, correct?
Yeah, very true. I mean, because at this point, you are tainted in a lot of ways.
Oh, I'm very tainted.
It's because you know a lot about it. So a lot of times an attorney, when an accountant already has that much knowledge, isn't going to put them under a Covell agreement simply because, you know, they don't want the IRS to even know that you even know this information if possible. Although it's too late in your case because the revenue agent knows you are representing the client.
Absolutely correct. So that's fine. No problem. 2 weeks later, Robert Frost shows up. And yes, Tom, you know who I'm talking about. He made it for me to give him the paperwork. And I said, absolutely not. I don't have a disclosure. And if I give it to anybody, I'm going to give it to the client and not you. He left, called me back and said, I'm coming back in. I said, if you come back in the office, I will have you arrested for trespassing. He never showed back up. I play hardball just like they do. I can scrap the best of them.
Right. But you thought your involvement at that point was over, unless you were going to be a witness at the trial against your former client.
Right.
I did not know that until the indictment came down September of 2020, Labor Day weekend of 2020. He signed the 2011 return, sent it to AUR with the letter. That would have been in September or October 2013.
Basically, you're not going to be a part of the work that you've handed off to the attorney now. At what point after you were indicted did you realize that the attorney was kind of turning on you?
I knew this issue with my client wasn't resolved. I knew he had pending criminal charges. I thought my involvement was over when Robert Frost came through the door in 2014-2015 timeframe.
So that's quite a while later. You're going about your life thinking that this issue might have been resolved for your client.
Correct. This started January 20th. This happened over the summer month. There was two or three more meetings with the attorney. Probably the fourth meeting, I had everything put together. I lost the case Christmas of 14 because that's when Dennis Boyle said, I no longer want you to do that. Then in 18, he was tied up in litigation going back and forth with Robert Frost, Dennis Boyle, and the Internal Revenue Service negotiating what he's going to plead guilty to. In that time frame, they brought his live-in cohabitating girlfriend in. She walked into the investigative agent's office. Two attorneys laid down a piece of paper and said, we're here to talk. We'll tell you whatever you want, but we need this hold harmless agreement signed. And the IRS looked at her and said, no, absolutely not. We don't play that way. I found all this out during the trial. Now, I think my attorney may have known some of it, but not the full details. We found this all out during the course of the trial. We don't want you. We want Michael Powers. So in that 19 timeframe, they were negotiating what Michael Powers would agree to plead guilty to. They got him on one count of filing a false tax return, understatement of taxes of $110,000 instead of three counts of the return, filing a false tax return, an understatement of taxes by $330,000. Once he entered his plea agreement, when she was there, when his girlfriend was there talking to Secret Service, the investigator.
Right.
What they asked her, the money that Michael Powers was giving you for, you were getting $600 a week. He gives that to me to help me take care of my children and myself.
The claim is from the IRS that the girlfriend was really an employee and that you conspired with this guy to hide this employee and get away with not doing wage reporting and paying payroll tax on it.
She never mentioned anything about work. The Secret Service and the investigative agent did not ask her about compensation for work. It was, he's giving that to me to take care of my children, myself, as we cohabitate. She went in, and when they investigated her, when she talked to them the first time, she said, no, this is money he gives me to take care of my children and myself. Michael Powers enters into the plea agreement, signs the plea agreement. 2 months later, she goes back in and recants her story and says, no, it was really wages. And she goes back in at that point in time with Robert Frost, who was Michael Powers' attorney.
And of course, once her statement switches, you know, ultimately, when it comes to your situation, That inconsistency is never going to help the government's case against you.
Never. That's why she was not brought to trial as a witness.
Oh, so they didn't even call her as a witness.
The government never called her as a witness. My attorney dug that all out of the investigative agent and the revenue agent's testimony.
Oh, wow. So he had to testify in front of the jury that she didn't claim that she was an employee. She came back later and changed the story.
Investigative agent had to tell the story. Walked in, two attorneys, hold harmless agreement. We don't want you. We want Michael Parris. They sat down and interrogated her for 6 to 8 hours. She left. Michael Parris entered into the plea agreement. 2 months later, Robert Frost marches her back in. No, this is really wages. And she recanted the original testimony 4 to 6 months earlier.
That sounds like a setup to me.
Oh, 100%. Now, where the government, where they hung their hat at and they got spanked on was that I told Michael Parris to lie to the revenue agent. We were outside the shop, once again, 7:30 in the morning, nobody around, no customers, no vendors, nobody around.
No employees.
Nobody acting as employees or acting as contractors, including the cohabitating girlfriend. And we were standing basically in a triangle. The revenue agent looked at me and said, does he have any employees? I looked at Mike Parris and said, Agent Reedy wants to know if you had anybody in 2010, 11, or 12 that would be considered employees or independent contractors in your shop. He looked at me and said, no. I said, no, don't tell me. Tell Agent Reedy. Mr. Reedy, I had no employees or what would appear to be employees or independent contractors in my shop.
Now, to me, that conversation is not you instructing the client to do anything. You simply took the agent's question. You did not answer it. You simply redirected it to the client and asked them, and then they answered the question.
I took the revenue agent's question, rephrased it into a statement that a gentleman with a high school education could understand and truthfully and honestly answer.
So the government never alleged that you and the taxpayer actually had a private discussion where you agreed to conspire. Their argument was that three-way discussion was the conspiracy.
That is their claim. That one conversation was you so-called conspiring. And so then I take it that the written documentation were the examiner's notes from that field visit.
They're hanging their hat on that. But when they got Agent Reedy on the stand, my attorney asked him, did this conversation take place? And the agent said, to the best of my recollection, that is exactly the conversation that we had. Their argument was that three-way discussion was a conspiracy. And within a very short period of time, and when I say short, I mean, I will say 1 to 10 days, we incorporated Michael Parris' business from Parris Automotive Service to Parris Automotive Service, Inc., put him on the payroll. 2 weeks later, he comes back and says, I have these individuals I need to put on payroll. And this was in 2014, not 10, 11, or 12. As a matter of fact, there was a whole year separation between those audits. And they're saying, because I did that then, I knew back then he had employees.
Right.
I'm fat, bald-headed, pigtailed on a flying carpet, but I certainly don't have a crystal ball.
My crystal ball was broken a long time ago, Frank. I get that. I really understand that.
So let's talk a little bit about this undercover agent. What did they ask you? What did they try to induce you to say?
It was August or September of 19. They sent an undercover in. I had no idea it was an undercover. That's why they called undercover. The undercover agent came in and said, hey, I'm from Pittsburgh. My girlfriend's from this area. And we had some nice chatting. We talked back and forth. And I said, well, what's going on? He said, I got this notice from the IRS, and it was an automated unreported notice. He showed me the tax return. He had $25,000 worth of income. He had $3,000 worth of expenses, paid tax on $22,000, go through. And then he showed me the AUR, and he's got $30,000 worth of unreported income on 1099s. I looked at the tax return, looked at the 1099s, and said, did you receive this money? Yes. How did you miss it? I don't know. I said, okay, well, I'm going to tell you right now, you're not going to be happy with your tax return. Well, what do you mean? I said, you've got $30,000 in unreported income in 15% tax bracket, It's $4,500. 15% Social Security, $4,500. I said, there's a couple of small adjustments there. You're going to owe $9,000. Oh, man, I can't do that. I can't pay that. I said, well, let me see your Schedule C again. Well, he had one thing for insurance. He had a bank statement that said insurance payment, $1,800. I said, we're probably going to need a receipt for that. I said, I know you're not happy, but do you understand where we're at? Yeah. And he said, well, here, I got this expense I didn't put. And he pushed a piece of paper across the desk to me, had three columns on it, maybe five or six lines, date, dollar amount, and hours. I said, what's this for? Well, that's for my girlfriend. I paid her to help me with a job down at my friend's condo. I said, where was the friend's condo? Myrtle Beach. I said, so you, the girl you're cohabitating with, went to Myrtle Beach, painted the friend's condo. Where's that income at? Well, that was in the original amount reported. I said, you have no food, no lodging. He said, yeah, I want to take these deductions. I said, no, that's your girlfriend. You cohabitate with her. The IRS has a real problem taking income from one tax bracket and shifting it to another tax bracket. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, we change this return and add deductions. The IRS is going to audit, has the potential to audit the bookends of this return. Oh, what do you mean? I said, if you're going to change this return, they're already going to be suspicions to say, what did he not do in this year and what did he not do in this year? And they're going to audit those returns, potentially. I said, do you want that? Well, no. He said, but I want to take these wages. I said, if we take those wages, they'll probably audit your girlfriend. Do you want that? You and her cohabitate. Do you want that? No, we can't have that. And that was said and it was captured on tape.
They didn't get what they were hoping for on that tape. They were hoping you would give him some advice that said, yeah, go ahead and take it. They'll never know.
No, there was no workman's comp policy. There was no written time cards other than a sheet of paper with figures on that to me. And that there's a term used called self-serving in the legal field. That's the way I viewed that piece of paper, was self-serving.
Yeah, there was nothing behind it. He just walked in with these deductions and said, please put them on my return, right?
Correct.
And they wanted you to basically, hopefully, repeat what they purported you told the other taxpayer so that they could use that as a wedge to force you to plead guilty or charge you with something else. That's really what that came down to.
But you didn't. What I heard you say, Frank, is,
right,
you know, do you have receipts for all this stuff? Did they introduce that in trial, Frank?
No, they skipped right over it. But they did. They did use the point of the tape when I said, no, we're not using that. And they shut it off at that point in time. They did not go through with the rest of the verbiage because it would have shot them right down.
Oh, of course. So they didn't put on the evidence of the tape saying, hey, you tried to get me to say something. I didn't say it.
Now, Frank, the thing I don't understand about even this whole case trajectory is they tried to bait you with an undercover. You're theoretically, they think you're a corrupt enrolled agent. But then when they actually get someone in your office that you have no idea is an undercover, you do things by the book. So shouldn't that really have cast doubt on this entire debacle at that point? I mean, to me as a reasonable person, this should have ended at that point, frankly.
When my attorney read the letter where it uses MP as the initial, he looked at this, he said, this is a he said, she said, this case shouldn't even be here.
Well, especially since they tried to goad you into repeating this supposed violation of the law and you completely denied it and you did things on the up and up. So you aren't the corrupt EA that they're trying to paint you as. You actually are on tape doing things the way that we're supposed to be doing.
That's correct.
And they rewarded MP by making a plea offer, and he was not required to serve time. His fine was substantially lowered in exchange for his participation in this little scheme.
Correct.
And of course, I read some of the objections, Frank, and the government was objecting to allowing you guys to cross-examine or examine MP on what he got in exchange for his testimony.
They lost every objection that they gave to the judge for my attorney.
But again, it's about their ability to persuade a jury to see things a certain way. And so it looks like from their point of view and the case they put on, it makes it seem like this upstanding client contacted the IRS and said, oh my goodness, this preparer is just advising me to do all kinds of illegal things. And don't you want to get him? And they said, oh, yes, we'll go after this guy. And if you testify, we'll give you a break on your problems that you're facing.
And they did. They absolutely positively did. And my attorney brought that up. And he said, my attorney said to him, did you get a break or did you cut any deals? Well, no, I lost my seat. I lost my seat on the zoning, township zoning board. I'm now a convicted felon. I can't own firearms. I like to hunt. I lost my pilot's license. So everything was about him.
Yeah. Poor him. I feel so bad. Really? Are you kidding?
He was the one that substantially underreported, didn't even tell you about the 1099s, had a whole shop full of employees.
Oh, I didn't do the return that was being audited with the 1099. He had a CPA that returned, and the CPA passed. The IRS could not even get to the person that did the return to investigate or inquisit on them, because he was laying 6 foot under pushing daisies.
Oh, right.
So they were grasping for straws.
Stay tuned for part two of our interview with Frank Kelly, when he tells us all about the trial and the aftermath of the verdict. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We're happy you decided to join us, and we hope you consider subscribing to the show and even share it with some friends who could use a Tax Crime Junkie podcast in their life. Help us spread the word and come back for more.
We hope you'll join us again next week as we continue our mission to find the loopholes that went left and close them for good. Until next time, remember that every crime has a trail that leads to the truth.